and less hatred. So worldwide, the source of war and famine and so forth, to a great extent, is the human heart and mind. And personally, it's the same. Much of the suffering that we experience in our life, there will be a change of pleasure and pain and pleasure and pain. That's the nature of things. They keep changing back and forth. Anybody not have that? But much of the suffering of our life is created by our response to it, by our fears, by our greed, by our delusion, by our lack of forgiveness. So it's important, if we're going to open, to acknowledge this. And in doing so, there then arises a sense of another possibility. And that possibility is within us a sense of greater awareness, greater compassion, greater freedom. Is there anyone in this room who doesn't sense that they could live more compassionately, more wakefully, in a freer way? That's your Buddha nature that you touch. You understand that there's this other potential. Buddha, Jesus, whoever you feel, illustrates that. This is from Pope John the 23rd. It often happens that I wake at night and begin to think about a serious problem and decide I must tell the Pope about it. Then I wake up completely and remember I am the Pope. So that's this understanding that there is sorrow and there is suffering. Much of it's created by us. And that there's some other way in this world, individually and collectively. Now, how can we get to that? How can we live that other way? The second part of right understanding is the belief in karma. And that doesn't have anything to do with past lives in Tibet or mystical stuff or things like that. Karma is simply the law of cause and effect. That what we do or how we are creates how we will be. If you practice hatred, and in various situations of your life you practice getting angry and then spiteful and hateful, after a while, as situations arise, what will be your habit? You'll be hateful. And then how will the world start to treat you back? Anybody notice? It will treat you back angrily or hatefully. And so you have within you the seeds to create that. Similarly, if we practice awareness, or if we train kindness or compassion, after a while, that too grows, becomes a part of our being, gets nourished in the garden of our life. And so the whole of our life and the world around us start to change. That's what karma means. Somebody asked a friend of mine who teaches, could you explain karma really simply? And she said, sure. Karma means you don't get away with nothing. Right? That how we act, how we treat one another, what we think, what we do, is creating the patterns for our life and the world around us. And if that's so, then our spiritual development isn't by accident. It's not just going to drop down from heaven, well, God is going to come and grace us and everything will be fine. God has already done his share or her share. And we've been given this incredible life. And what's possible now is to sense that inner potential of our Buddha nature, or whatever you call it, and to nourish that through a systematic development, training. Now, the second step of the Eightfold Path, after seeing that there is suffering and that it's created for the most part by us, and sensing some other potential, is called right attitude. Or right aspiration. And it's really how one undertakes a meditation practice. The correct attitude in these teachings is very simple. It's one of openness or discovery. Looking to see what is true. It's not so much to prove something or to change yourself or to do self-improvement. There are a lot of self-improvement clubs in Marin County. Some of them are quite beneficial. But the basic root in meditation practice is not self-improvement, but it's the discovery of what is true and relating to that with compassion and with wisdom. Right attitude is beginning to see for ourselves what there is. There's a saying in India that when a pickpocket meets a saint, he sees only the saint's pockets. Do you understand? That what you want, if you're interested in something, limits what you see. If you walk down the street and you're hungry, what do you see? Food, restaurants, McDonald's, Italian, French, Thai, Vietnamese, whatever it is. You don't see shoe stores. You don't notice clothing stores. Our desires blind us. So in the process of meditation, it's the opposite that's asked for. It is an openness to discover what is true. How does the mind work? What is going on in our hearts? What is the nature of the rhythms of the breath and the body? Discovery. It also requires a kindness. It's not something that you learn by force, and there's a deep opening that happens in meditation, but it's like a rose. You can't pull the petals open. It opens through the heart of kindness, through an attention that is soft enough to really listen to deeper and deeper levels of our being and our mind and our feelings and what makes us up. Now, the third, fourth, and fifth steps of this Eightfold Path all have to do with relating meditation to how we live. As I said in the beginning, it's not just sitting on the cushion, because that's not of much value to us in Western life, but it's learning how to relate in a wakeful or conscious or compassionate way in the whole of our life. So these steps talk about what's traditionally called virtue or morality or ethics. If you find virtue or morality not a pleasant word, listen anyway. And I'll go through it and see if it makes sense to you. You don't have to believe anything here, but listen and see what resonates in your being and in your heart. So they are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Change that word. Conscious speech, conscious action, and conscious livelihood. Conscious speech says this. We spend a lot of time talking. Anybody notice? Most of it is done on automatic pilot. We do it, but we're not so conscious. We talk and we listen and so forth, yet we're not very awake. Conscious speech or right speech has several parts. First, it says, refrain from speaking in ways that harm other people. Don't lie. Don't gossip and undermine and backbite. Don't use words to create suffering. Not because you're not supposed to, but see what it's like to sit and meditate after a day of lying. Try it. It just doesn't work. If you want the heart to be at peace, or you want to come to some peace in the world, there's a meditative foundation, which is to let your words be in accord with what's true. Now, it's more than just not telling the untruth. It's really beginning to respect the power of speech. I had a friend who took a resolve in his practice to not gossip for a month. And by not gossiping, he wasn't even going to say positive things about someone who he knew when they weren't present. So this resolve was, if somebody's not there and I know them, I'm not going to talk about them. And he said it was extraordinary to discover what happened. 90% of his speech was eliminated. Words have a tremendous power. Do you know those few words that you said that you're really happy you said to someone? That really made a difference? Or those other words that you said that you really wish you hadn't? It means beginning to respect speech as a part of our awakening. There's a story of an old Sufi master who comes into a village to heal a young child. And all the villagers crowded around. It was the headman's son. And he just said a few simple prayers and said now he will be well. Well, someone who didn't believe in all this spiritual stuff stood up and said, what do you mean? He says a few words and the kid's supposed to get better. And everyone turns to look at this man and the master strides over to him. And he says, what do you mean to say that? You know nothing of this. You are an absolute, total, ignorant fool. This in front of all the villagers. Well, the man is enraged. He turns red. His body starts vibrating. He's about to strike out at the master. And the master says, see, if a word or two can turn you red and fill you with energy and anger, why shouldn't a few other words have the power to heal? Our words have great power. So if you wish to begin to cultivate a conscious or meditative life, you can also begin to work with conscious speech. The basic rules are to say that which is true and that which is useful or kind. Because you can say what's true in a really harmful way, kind of brutal honesty. Do you know what I mean? It's to couple speaking the truth with that which is helpful to others. And after a while, it starts to create the conditions in your heart and in your life and around you of living that kind of consciousness. In fact, if you want to practice a teaching or a practice to work with in modern times, working with right speech would be plenty. You could get enlightened from that. I mean it. To really listen every time you speak to see if it's connected with your heart and if it's true and kind. Right action is the same. It says to not harm through our actions. Traditionally, the precepts include not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct. Let me talk about them a little bit, how they relate to the practice we're beginning. Not to kill. I don't know if you've become aware of it, but even small creatures don't seem to like it very much. And we get, in our culture, we get kind of insulated from the world. We have our heaters and our air conditioners and our cars and everything kind of protects us. And then one little creepy crawly and we have to do it away because it somehow it becomes a threat to our safety or something like that. And we have a cavalier attitude toward life. To not kill really means to begin to cultivate a reverence toward life. And to take care with it, that we share the earth with many beings. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker one autumn, showed two hunters and two deer on the hillside. The deer were talking one to another. One deer said, why don't they thin their own herds? It's easy to make an excuse, but I haven't seen too many deer, and they do eat our garden some, but if there's too many something around here, it's not deer. And so it means to begin to cultivate a caring and a reverence to minimize your harm. Of course we live on other life. Life lives on life. You have to respect that, but to do it in a way that minimizes harm. Not to steal, it's the same thing. It doesn't make for a very good community life to have people stealing. It also makes for a very difficult time meditating. Again, try and sit and meditate after a day of stealing. It doesn't work very well because you're in conflict with something deeper in your own nature. Again, to not steal can be listened to on a deeper level. It means not to act in ways that are piggy. We share this earth, this environment, with so many beings, and to be sensitive to that, to the resources, to be respectful so that we live in harmony with it. To not kill, to not steal, to refrain from sexual misconduct. Again, it's very simple. Traditionally, the precept says, and they're called training precepts because you practice with them, I undertake to practice the training of refraining from sexual activity that causes harm to any other person, a second or third person. How many people in this room have made an idiot of themselves around sexuality? Don't raise your hand. We already know the answer, right? It's a very powerful force. It needs respect, and it too needs to be taken into our hearts. It too needs to be connected with our spiritual life if we want to awaken. So it says, pay attention to this powerful area and see that the acts on one hand can come out of greed and exploitation and attachment and controlling or manipulation, or sexuality can be associated with love, with intimacy, with communion, with caring for another person. And listen to where it comes from and begin to use that force as well to become conscious or awaken. The last part of this precept talks about alcohol and drugs, and I'll just say a few quick words about that. There are 20 million alcoholics in the U.S. and 10 million drug addicts, and 60 million people in their families or close to them who suffer from that. Then there are workaholics and sexaholics and gambleaholics and whatever. The power of addiction. How many people's lives have been touched in painful ways from addiction? Many, many people in this room, if I asked for hands to raise, I know that the majority of hands would go up. This precept says, pay attention to the power of that and be really respectful of it. Don't use intoxicants in any way that lead to loss of awareness. I mean, it's hard enough to be aware, isn't it? So it's to be respectful of that and their powers. That's right speech, right action, right livelihood, which fits together with it in a very simple way, is to make your work also a part of your spiritual life. One Zen master friend of mine came after being a famous abbot in Korea and running a number of temples and so forth. He wanted to teach in America, and he decided to come by himself without all the pomp and circumstance. And he just got a job in a university town, tried to learn English, and the job he got was in the laundromat. He didn't speak very good English, and so he was wearing his Zen robes, this little bald guy, and he'd go in and he'd mop the floors and put quarter in the change machine, fix things up and so forth. And gradually the students at the university would come in and see this funny-looking guy in the laundromat, and they'd ask, who are you? And he'd say, I Zen teacher. That's about all he could say. He invited them up to sit, and he showed them how to sit in Zen style in his apartment. And over a year or so, working in the laundromat, gradually people came and got interested, and his first Zen center was founded. And then a couple more people came, and he had a second Zen center. He quit the laundromat, and now, like most of them, he drives quite a nice car and has centers all around and so forth. But anyway, what was wonderful was that he took whatever job there was, and he did it in the spirit of making that part of his practice. Right livelihood says, first, try to work in a way that doesn't harm other beings. Don't sell guns or drugs or other kinds of weapons. But more deeply than that, use the circumstances of work to awaken. Have you not been served by a waiter or waitress once in a while that's as if the Buddha themselves came and served you and then said some very wise thing and then disappeared? Remember those moments? You know? On the other hand, you've been served in the opposite way, I'm sure, too. Any kind of work, because it's a giving back to our world, we need this exchange, can be used to awaken. Even if it's very boring. Because, quite frankly, what could be more boring than sitting and watching your breath? Right? Whatever your work is, it can't be any more boring than what we just did. So it's not a question of that it's rote or that it's boring, but what is the spirit that you do it at? Could you work on an assembly line and do that with mindfulness so that you wake? Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Then the last three pieces of the Eightfold Path, to kind of summarize them, have to do with taking this practice inward. And they are right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness. If you don't remember these things, they're all in a book and they're tapes and stuff, so you can just sort of let come into you whatever's useful tonight. Right effort is key in meditation or spiritual life, and the meaning is very simple. Right effort is the effort to be awake. It's not the effort to make things different or make yourself happy or high or this way or that way. It's the effort to come into the present and relate to what's here with wakefulness and kindness. To see what's here and bring some balance as well to it. The effort to be present. So in your meditation, all kinds of things will happen. You'll be bored, you'll be restless, you'll be happy, you'll be sad, you'll weep, you'll grieve sometimes. You'll find great joy and rapture coming. All of those are part of the meditation. The effort that's important to learn is the effort to be present with whatever's there. And to do it with some sense of balance. Now the last two are right concentration and right mindfulness. And they really come together. That's what we started here and we'll do again in a minute. Before you can really understand something, you have to be present with it. That's what concentration means. It means coming into the present and being steady, like a candle in a windless place. Or again, it's like training the puppy, bringing the puppy back again and again and again. Making ourselves quiet enough and steady enough so that we can feel what is going on in our body. Or what is there in the heart? Or how is the mind working? Kabir, the Indian poet, said, "I don't know what kind of a god we're talking about. The caller chants in a loud voice at dusk. Does he think God is deaf? Don't you know that God hears the ringing of the anklets on the feet of an insect as it walks?" And so part of what this concentration means is this art of listening. Meditation is the development of an inner stillness or steadiness which can begin to listen to ourselves in ways that we've kept too busy to do before. It's not going to come easily, I promise you. When you first start to sit, you'll be all over the map. But it's an art just like you could learn to paint oil colors, or just like you could learn any other great art, to play beautiful music. Over time, it's an inner art, and it's wonderful. The last step is right mindfulness, and that's the key to all of this practice. Mindfulness means being here in the present with what is here. And that's the essence of the Buddha's awakening, of the practice that we'll do. Mindfulness means being present without trying to change it. Seeing it and opening to what's present with understanding, with kindness, with clarity. That's not an easy thing. Usually, when we're relating to what's here, what we relate from is how we would like to fix it. Project mentality. You'll see it in meditation. Do you know what I mean? We spend our whole lives trying to fix things. And meditation is stopping the projects and the fixing and just coming into relation to what's here. Now I'll say one more thing about mindfulness and then I'll be done this Eightfold Path. One of the reasons that makes mindfulness worthwhile is if any of you are interested in love. And I suspect some of you are, most of us in fact, that's the deepest thing that we desire. There's only one place that we can love. We can't love in the past. That's called a memory. Might be a good memory, but it's just a memory. We can't love in the future. That's called a fantasy. The only place where we can love, be loved and love, is in the present. To love another person, the rain, the trees, the earth around us, the world that we're in. And to touch love, to love and be love, requires a living in the reality of the present. So these are the traditional steps or context within which meditation is taught, that one realizes that speech and action, taking care with one's life, provide the ground for the development of concentration and calm and an opening of the body and mind. I was called by a friend to go to the hospital at the UC Med Center some years ago. Her brother, it seemed, was dying of cancer. So I went in to see him, and he was a reasonably young guy. He was 38. He had a family and a big business. He was a contractor that did development. Quite successful. He had a big ranch and a sailboat and everything. He'd done a little bit of Zen in the 60s and a little LSD and kind of messed around with that stuff and then just dropped it and went into business and got fully into it. Drove along one day down the road and fainted for a little bit at the wheel of his car, and after medical checkup determined he had a brain tumor. So he went in the hospital and they did CAT scans and biopsies, and they came in that day and said, "We're sorry to tell you, but you have melanoma, which is a rapid growing kind of cancer. You have a tumor in your brain. If we don't do surgery, you probably have 6 weeks to live at most, 4 to 6 weeks. If we do surgery, the tumor is in the speech and understanding area of your brain. And so afterward, you may no longer be able to speak or read or write or understand any language. We'd like to operate tomorrow morning. Please let us know." So I went in to see this person. And as you can imagine, he was in a really extraordinary state. And it was even though it was very frightening for him in some ways, it was also a privilege to be with him. And we talked, and the only thing he wanted to talk about was his spiritual life. Forget what he had built and done and so forth. He went back to draw on those few things that he had learned in meditation. Because when you come to big changes in your life, they don't take your American Express traveler's checks. When you go to the change booth for the big changes, the only currency that's of any value is the currency of the heart. And it's really what you've learned in how to let go and in your compassion and your wisdom and your strength of being. So we talked about that a long time. That's all he wanted to talk about, what it meant to be alive and die, both. And then he looked at me and he said, "You know, I take a drink of water, the San Francisco City water, and it tastes so sweet, so good. Or I look out on my windowsill and there are these pigeons on UC Medical Center, like fifth floor or something, and they fly off." And he said, "It's so beautiful to see a bird just take off and fly in the air." He said, "Maybe I've said enough in my life. Maybe I should just listen." And so he elected to have the surgery. He had a famous surgeon, and after about 18 hours in surgery, he came to the recovery room the next day, and his sister went in to see him in the morning, and he looked up at her, and he said, "Good morning." And somehow they'd been able to take enough of the tumor out without disturbing the brain cells in speech center so that he could still speak. He lived for 8 years after that. He's died since this time in an entirely different way. He just completely changed his life. He still did some work. He didn't throw his business away. But he lived from such a deeper place. And he became a counselor for many people, people who were sick, people who were grieving and going through difficulty. And he did it with such love and such understanding because he came in that experience to really deeply appreciate being awake and living his life. And that's what meditation offers. Questions before our next sitting? We'll sit in a minute, but please.
I get a little confused on the precepts of choosing a right behavior and not interfering, you know, just observing.
Yes. In the sitting that we're doing, we are cultivating a non-choosing awareness that just sees what's present. Out of that, out of coming to bring the breath and body and mind together and being more settled in the present, then comes the possibility of making wiser choices, or making choices that come because we listen more deeply to their impact in us and on others, so that we respond rather than react. So the first step, and a lot of what meditation is about, is listening. And then out of that listening comes the possibility, since we will act, we do all the time, of acting in a more attentive or caring or wise way. Okay, let's sit again. 15 minutes. So find your posture again, or some posture. And at home you can experiment with cushions and chairs, whatever way you like. Let your eyes close gently when you're ready. And we'll just stay with this first basic exercise of bringing the mind and the body and the heart all together here by using the ever-present movement of breath. You can use it here, you can use it when you're running and jogging, when you're driving. Your breath is always with you. With your eyes closed, then come into the body and be aware of what you notice. If there's any obvious tension, try to soften or relax that. So that you're both relaxed and alert. Let your shoulders be soft and your hands relax. Let the eyes and the face be soft. Let the belly be easy, soft. And feel the rhythm of the breath as it shows itself in your body. Let the breath bring the mind and body and heart together, coming back to it over and over when you wander away. Feel the breath in whatever place it shows itself most clearly. For some of you, it may be in the nose, the upper lip, or the back of the throat. For others, the breath may be felt more in the chest or belly. Notice wherever you're observing it, that at that place there's a beginning and an end of the in-breath. Whether it's at the nose or the belly, certain sensations, and a beginning and end of the out-breath. Feel the whole movement of the breath. And use the breath to calm and steady the mind. Can you notice when the breath just begins? Notice if there's a space between breaths and let that be okay. If there is, then just feel your body sitting here, receiving the next breath when it comes. If the breath gets soft, also what helps in a daily practice, what's absolutely critical, is not being idealistic. You will sit, if you do it during this week in a regular way, and maybe on Monday you'll be able to be with your breath all right. On Tuesday it will be terrible, and on Wednesday it will be worse than that. Then Thursday it might be better again, and Friday again terrible. That is not your job. Your job is to stamp your little card in the time clock, put your fanny on the cushion or the chair, and sit down and take whatever you get, which is whatever state your body and mind is in, and begin right there to relate to that. Even if you're frantic at the end of a day and you sit and you can watch 3 breaths in 20 minutes and the rest is a lot of thinking, do it anyway. Hold your body still and watch at least 3 breaths. It's through the practice of it, just like getting your fingers to work a piano, that after a while you learn the art. So a regular time, a regular place, not having much expectation, just doing it. Don't be discouraged. We've spent probably 100 million moments of wandering mind in this very lifetime. So to expect to change the wandering mental habit overnight is not very likely. It works, but it takes perseverance and a gentleness and a training of yourself. Any questions about daily practice?
Do you have any suggestions about how to know when 15, 20 minutes are up?
Yes. You can do 2 things. You can either get a little timer, you know, set a beep watch or something, or some kind of timer, or you can peek. I peek myself, you know, I'm a peeker, but you can do it either way, and you get a little sense of it after a while. Anything else?
How do you deal with interruptions?
Well, you mean like the phone ringing and stuff? If you can turn it off, try and make a place where there isn't. But if there's some necessary interruption, then you do it and you go back and you try to sit again for the following 10 minutes. You just do the best you can with it. But see if you can create a space with a minimum of interruptions, even if it's just for 15 minutes. Sometimes we get interrupted. Having children, I know that very well. Please.
Is there any special way we should hold our hands?
Your hands should be wherever they're comfortable. They can be in your lap or on your knees, in whatever way allows your shoulders to be relaxed and your chest to be open and your belly soft. To experiment with posture, to find a way to sit where you're upright and at the same time relaxed, this balance of being awake, upright, and yet soft. And so you might experiment with a couple of different hand positions until you find what feels good for you. Last question.
Should the breath be through the nostrils?
For the most part, I recommend that, but sometimes people can't do that because they have a cold or whatever. In that case, you can be aware of the breath through the mouth and so forth. It's not a breathing exercise. It's really an exercise of training of awareness, of presentness. So wherever you feel the breath is okay. Now, a quick story. There was a young Hasidic rabbi who trained in mystical things not very well, but he decided he wanted to teach anyway. And he went to a town where there was a famous master, set up shop, and nobody came to study with him. So he thought, I've got to get myself some students. How will I do that? And he devised a plan. He went one day to the master, who was surrounded by many, many students, and he had in his hand a small bird. And his idea was this. He went and he faced the master, and he said, if you're such a great master, tell me if the bird in my hand is alive or is it dead? The idea was this. If the master said that the bird was dead, he'd open his hand and the bird would fly out. The master would be wrong and embarrassed, and the young guy would get some students. If the master said that the bird was alive, he would quickly crush it in his hand and say, see, it's dead. And again, the master would be wrong, and he would get some students for himself. So he gets himself ready, and he goes in front, and everyone's watching, and he has the bird, little bird in his hand, and he confronts the master, and he says, well, you're such a great master, you tell me. Is the bird in my hand alive or is it dead? And the master looks back at him and he says, really, my friend, it's up to you. Similarly, I'll try to give you the best instructions for practice that I know how. We're starting really simply, just feeling the breath in the body, training the mind, bringing it back gently like the puppy, noticing where you feel it at the nose or the belly, establishing a regular practice, seeing that meditation has a broad context, that how you live your life, your speech and your action will connect with how quiet you become on your pillow. Give as useful teachings as I can. The rest is for you to take and practice and find what value you can in it.
This concludes the first class on the inner art of meditation. Our program continues with the second class with Jack Kornfield.
I'd like to welcome you to this second in a series of five classes, which are an introduction to Vipassana, or Buddhist insight meditation. When we came last week, I both talked about my own background and that I have trained as a monk in various Buddhist monasteries in Asia, but also I'm a father and a householder and a psychologist, and I'm interested in making the meditation practices and teachings of the East that were very important to me useful and valuable in a Western context. So that's how this will be taught, not as Buddhism where you become Buddhists, but really as meditation that might be useful for you as you sit or walk or drive or eat or relate to the people in your lives. And there's some wonderful tools. I learned more in those monasteries than I did in a lot of years of graduate school doing a PhD. There was a very deep kind of psychology and understanding. And some of those we will cover as we go through what is called the foundations of mindfulness, or the basic aspects of awareness that we can train in. Now, last week, we started in a simple way, and I'll review it when we do our first sitting, by working with the breath as the first object of meditation. And we really talked about how the step that's necessary to begin a spiritual practice is to come into the present moment. Like the sign in Las Vegas said, you must be present to win. If you want to discover how your mind works or what's going on with fear or why you're restless or how you might live more contentedly or what's happening in your body, the first thing that's necessary is to bring the body and mind together, to get here in some immediate way with what's present. So beside introducing posture and sitting last week, I also talked about the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. The gist of it is simply that if we want to awaken, in Buddhism the word Buddha means to awaken, what is necessary is to develop this capacity to be conscious or aware. Initially we'll work with our breath last week, and this week with our body, and then following that with feelings in the heart next week, and then with the mind and all of its plans and memories and strategies and creativity, and then finally with eating and walking and how to make it part of our life. But if we want to do that, we need to have an understanding first that spiritual life isn't just in one posture, but it is really how we relate to waking up the whole of our life. That if you want to calm yourself or open your heart or see in a clear way, you have to connect your life to that and speak what's more truthful, act in ways that are more conscious and less harmful, get in harmony with the world around. And then the correct effort that's necessary is simply the effort to be still and listen. It's not the effort to change oneself, but to discover the nature of the mind and the body, and both how we do relate to it and what is our potential, our Buddha nature, our potential of love, or our potential of understanding. And again, I read a quote, I don't know where it is, last week from Pope John the 23rd, where he said, "Sometimes I wake at night and I start thinking about a problem, difficulty, and decide that I must go and talk to the Pope about it. And then I wake up more completely and remember I am the Pope." And in some way, that's what meditation is about, is really remembering or reawakening this capacity that each of us has to live more wisely, more lovingly, more compassionately, and more fully in our experience. So we were going to take a few more minutes for questions before the first sitting. The questions that were asked so far for those who came in late, someone talked about it getting a little easier as they sat during the week, which is terrific, that their body started to settle down. It was then only their mind that didn't, which is pretty good as far as this game goes. And then somebody else said that for them it was the opposite, that their body settled a little bit, but they got more and more restless. And how one might work with that. And we'll get to that as we go along. Then somebody else said their body started to move and rock, and I suggested sitting as best as you can in a way that's fairly still, even though that release of movement is kind of common or natural. And someone else noticed that they think a lot, and as they paid attention carefully, they saw that they did most of the thinking when they were afraid. And that when they weren't afraid, then there wasn't all this planning. And when the planning was there, it was almost the signal that there was fear underneath. So there were a number of other questions, people who raised their hands.
I started to look forward to doing it every day, but about, I don't know, probably 15 minutes later, I started to plan about how I was going to reward myself for doing 20 minutes.
So you look forward to it for a while, and then 15 minutes into it, it got physically difficult, and then you thought, well, after I'm done, I'll get up and I'll have an ice cream or whatever reward is in your particular system, a beer. Good. Other people. This is all really the stuff of beginning meditation. Please.
Initially, it brought up a lot of emotions for me. In the first few days, it was okay, and then I found during the day I was in a lot of pain and stuff, and I was sort of dreading meditating. I didn't agitate or notice more of that.
So for you, sitting initially served to bring up or make you aware of a great deal of emotion. And at first that was okay, but then it got more difficult to the point where you would be afraid to sit because it was going to bring more up. That's such an important question, as is the person who said their body's settling down but their mind is still restless, that I want to take a good part of an evening to address it. That's the good news. The not so good news is it's going to be next week rather than this week. Because this week we're going to still continue to work with the body, but I'll give you an answer that's just the gist of what we're going to get to. We started to work with the breath and use the breath as a way to bring the mind and body together instead of having the mind wander to Muir Beach or Los Angeles or Disneyland or 1958 or 1992 or God knows how many places you go, even in 15 minutes when we're here together, to bring the mind and body together and to start to train ourselves to be present. It's not an easy thing, but it's possible. Then when you do, what happens is you start to be aware of a lot more that's going on in your body, and you have to learn how to relate to it. And the basic relation, as we'll see this evening, will be to make that part of the meditation. Next week, when we start to work with the heart and the emotions, we will include that so that if you feel happy or frightened or sad and that arises, what you do is you sit with it and you name it the way we're naming the breath in and out. You name it sad, sad, or whatever. And you really let yourself feel it and begin to learn about it rather than trying to push it away. So that's a very simple answer, and I'll talk a lot more about really specifically how you can do that. In that sense, as I said last week, this meditation isn't one that takes an object like an image or a candle flame or a sacred word and says it over and over, but begins to use the stuff of our actual experience itself as the way to become meditative. You know how much of our life we live on automatic pilot? And how many meals, or how far we drive, or how you can even go to a really beautiful place. You can go out to Point Reyes Park or up in the Sierras, and you're walking along this gorgeous place, and for the past half an hour, 25 minutes has been thinking, what are you going to do when you get home, you know, and what you left, what was on the stove, what's in the bills for, you know, the tax season this year, and maybe even what you're going to tell somebody about what a great time you're having walking in the woods, right? But we don't live so much here. And the whole art or spirit of meditation is to train us or to awaken and establish this other possibility. And we started, in a moment we'll do it again, with the breath, and then this evening more with the body, and following that further with other dimensions of our life. So let's do our first sitting. Let me review in a few seconds about posture. Try to find a posture where you can sit both comfortably and stably so that your knees aren't way up in the air and you don't have to squirm around a lot. It may mean at home experimenting by sitting on several cushions instead of one so you're up high enough, or squatting on a cushion, or sitting on a chair or one of these little benches, and you would do well to experiment some to find some posture. Finding a place where you can sit that is stable and comfortable, where you can hold your body still for 15 or 20 minutes. The stilling of the physical body helps in the quieting of the mind. Then in a moment, when we start, we're going to close our eyes gently just to minimize distractions, and do the first exercise in the foundations of mindfulness, which is using the feeling or sensation of the breath to train the mind to not wander so much, to actually train or strengthen our awareness and concentration and be here more in the body. Now, I'll tell you one story before we start. I had a friend who was a meditator, and she lived in a commune in British Columbia in the 1960s. And when they were there, she got pregnant, and they decided just to have a natural home delivery. And there wasn't a doctor, and there wasn't a midwife, but it was commune and 60s, and it was au naturel, right? We'll just do it ourselves. The animals do it. We can do it. Well, that's great, but it turned out that the baby was a breech delivery, which means it was feet instead of head first, and the cord was wrapped some, and it was a long and very difficult labor, especially for inexperienced people. And then when the baby came out, he was very blue, and he didn't start to breathe, and they didn't have oxygen or anything there. And so they were rather frightened, and they held the baby, and then they started to do infant artificial respiration. just gently blowing into his lungs and so forth. And they'd do that for a little bit, and then they'd hold this little boy that they waited 9 months for, their son, their baby, and wait to see if he'd start to breathe. And he didn't. He'd pick him up and blow in his lungs a little bit more. He's fine now. He's 17. He's the star of his soccer team and school and stuff like that. So he did start to breathe, obviously. But his mother said to me sometime after that, she said, I'd been doing some meditation before that, and it was at that moment that I learned what it really meant to watch the breath, to feel the breath, and it wasn't even my own. She said, we just waited for the tiniest movement of breath. So for those of you who've been sitting for a week, in some ways the breath is boring. I know that's true. It's regular. Unless your head is underwater, you know, or you have a new... It becomes incredibly interesting at certain points of your life, you know? Or with a newborn baby. So for those of you who've been working with it for a week, what you might do tonight as we start again this first sitting with the breath for 15 minutes is to really begin to refine your awareness and let your eyes close now as you sit up. Let your eyes and face be soft, and your shoulders and arms and hands be relaxed. Let your back be straight but not rigid, so you're sitting up and the breath can move freely, and yet the rest of your body is relaxed. The belly is soft. Let the breath breathe itself in its own rhythms. And even if it feels tight or controlled, do the best you can to let go. Let it even be a little tight or controlled if that's what it does. Your job is to feel it wherever it shows itself. Sensations in the nose or the back of the throat, the movement of the chest, the rise and fall of the belly. See if you can notice the beginning of a breath. It has a beginning and a middle and an end. And feel the whole sensation of it in some place or other, the whole tickling at the nose, or the whole rising movement of the belly. Wherever you feel it, to stay with the duration of that breath. If it's helpful, you can say softly in the background, in during the in-breath and out during the out-breath, with 5% of your mind. Let 95% actually feel the sensations, the coolness, the pressure, the movement. And each time the mind wanders off, every one of those times, as soon as you notice it, let go of that place and come back gently and start with the next breath over and over. if the breath gets soft, let your attention also become very soft, to feel the subtle movement of the sensations. Use the breath as a place to learn to listen with your attention. Feel the sensations for the duration of the breath, wherever they show themselves. Sometimes there's a space between breaths. If there is a gap, then just be aware of feeling your body, the lips or the hands or the buttocks on the cushion, feeling and sensing in the body and waiting for the next breath to begin. Let the breath do whatever it will. Simply notice and feel how it is in this moment. One more minute. See if you can feel every breath for a minute. How was that? Any questions that come up from that sitting again together? Was it easier to sit together? Does that help or make it more difficult?
Yes.
It does help. You're too embarrassed to move, I know. Please.
I have pictures, so my eyes are closed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always there, and I find that if my eyes are lowered, I get one kind of picture,
mm-hmm.
and if I try to move up here,
mm-hmm.
then I get the universal eye, or the face of a big lion, or a big sun, or something
more, archetypal picture.
More archetypal, yes, up here. And down here, they're just, I mean, they can be anything, mm-hmm. from Disney characters, similar to Disney characters, to beautiful paintings, to anything. And so while I'm, you know, feeling like I'm focusing on my breath, I'm also sort of tripping out on the
mm-hmm.
pretty pictures.
It is Disney, by the way. That's exactly right. It's all Disney, done in much the same fashion. As best as you can, let the pictures or thoughts or other images that come, or words for that matter, for now let them be in the background. In a few weeks, when we start to look directly at mind, we're going to work.